record session number 12149, reel 5.
Captain Sutton, reel 5.
In Norfolk, Virginia, and I found myself at a table of eight with the Italian naval attaché in Washington. And he said, had I known Italy? And I said, well, I've been joined my ship at Naples recently and so on, and that I'd also known to the war. Attack targets in Italy. He said, oh, what targets do you attack in Italy? I said, Taranto. He said, you mean the attack on the Italian battle fleet in Taranto? I said, yes. And then, he said, I saw that. I was the gunnery officer of, and he said, which ship? He said, it was magnificent. He then took around and introduced me to all his friends, and we were terrific pals and on. This, again, is typical Italian. They are very generous, and they are full of admiration for skill. Well, that's Taranto. Stop.
Can you now go on to January 1941 when the Illustrious was attacked?
The Illustrious was covering a convoy in Malta when she was caught by a staff full of German dive bombers as they moved down specially for the purpose of cutting the sea routes through the Mediterranean. We had known for quite a time the Germans moving down dive bombers, but the captains of the fleet pressed the commander-in-chief that the Illustrious would remain in company with the main body of the ships instead of standing off as he should have been doing in this particular operation. Anyhow, I think that what I'll do on this is I'll describe my own experiences of this, because the action itself is again a classic which has been described time and again from the point of view of damage control. And what you're after really is personal reminiscences. I was off flying at that particular time because I'd had some other trouble, and my action station was meant to be with the command operations up on the bridge. When action stations went on that particular day, I was on my way by the quickest route, which is through the hangar, up to the bridge, when a bomb went off in the after lift well of the hangar. I was caught by the bomb, and my own impression was that there was a mass of flame and smoke, and that the ship was spinning around me. In actual fact, what happened was that I was caught by the blast through the after hangar door, which took me along a passageway and took me through two watertight doors, which actually were open at that stage. So by sheer luck, I was shot straight through two doors, whereas if I had been diverted just the smallest bit, I'd been pulled up against a bulkhead. I went through two watertight compartment doors and then found myself in the after lobby of the officers' cabins, very shaken and a bit wounded and bruised. Now, when you do endless training in the Navy for this sort of thing, and you have it dinned into you, and you don't know why, but it closed the ventilation, put out the fires, rescue the wounded, apply first aid, and you go on doing this again and again and again and again, again, and you think, my God, I've done this so much, I'm bored stiff. And in this particular case, this is what happened. Your training takes over, and although you are shattered and bruised, you do it. And I was putting out fires and rescuing wounded when I was caught by the next bomb. And the next thing I knew was that I was on the quarterdeck, laid out. something rescued me. Now, I came to with my Royal Marine servant, Tregaskis, bathing my face and saying, oh sir, what have they done to you? And I must have been rather amiss because I was sort of covered in soot from the fires and I was also bleeding quite heavily from the gash I'd got up here over the right eye. Anyhow, I came to, and the Royal Marines at that stage of the war were still your own personal bodyguard, and they looked after you. They were your personal, they were your Royal Marine attendant. They looked after your kit. When you went ashore, they went ashore with you, and so on. They were your bodyguard, they were your friend, and they were your protector. And this is what Tregaskis was for me. He had looked after us. I was fairly recently married. He had accompanied us when we moved from Ford down to Roeborough. He had looked after my wife and all the luggage and so on, and clustered us along. We got along on a troop train. Companion and friend. After a very short period, I recovered, and I then started applying first aid. Now, what had happened in those early bombings was that the wardroom, which is under the hangar, on the after end of the hangar, had been smashed to pieces. The wardroom was the after first aid dressing station in that ship. The sick bay in the forward end of the ship was the forward one, so you had two sick bays in effect, equipped, and the last one had been wiped out by the bombs. So instead of being wounded being taken to the wardroom, they were brought out into the quarterdeck, and there were a whole mass of people with all sorts of burns and shatters and things being laid out in the quarterdeck as they were brought out by various first aid parties. Applying first aid to these, and the one I remember particularly, there was a fighter pilot called Gregory who was brought out, and he was so badly shattered that I didn't know what to do with him. The whole of his back was raw, open, you could see his backbone. My consternation obviously showed in my face, because he said, Alfie, there's nothing you can do for me, I'm a goner. Go and help somebody else. But at that moment, I saw the Padre come onto the quarterdeck. And I called him over, he's Henry Lloyd, who became the Dean of Truro for many years, in the Navy. I called him over, and he then took over. He had morphia and morphine, and I gave him a shot and stayed with him. Only last year I was talking to Henry Lloyd about this sort of thing, and he said how he had watched the briefing for Taranto and how anxious he had been. He said, I looked at you young men in admiration and fear, because I thought you were all going to your deaths, and I loved you all, and I admired you greatly. And I said, well, I admired you too, Padre. And I said, I remember particularly how you came on to the quarter deck and how quiet you were and how calm and soothing the wounded and looking after them. And he said, yes, you know the sequel to that story. And I said, no. He said, the first aid party came along to take Gregory away, and they mishandled him, and I heard his backbone break. That's a terrible story. That's what happened. The illustrious bombing went on and on and on. The wounded from the quarterdeck were evacuated, had taken up all the ladders from the quarterdeck up to get over the hangar. The hangar was all burning. They had to go up over the flight deck, along the flight deck during the air raids, down the forward end of the flight deck, down into the sick bay. So the wounded had to be taken away. The ship was all burning. There were tongues of flame going up through the broken ladders. One had to pass men up through the flames, change people, get them up onto the flight deck and away. There were many dead, many wounded, and the sequel was that in Malta, two minesweepers put to sea after the bombing, the day after the bombing, ranged with the bodies of the dead from Illustrious and buried them at sea. Now, all that day, the day of the bombing, I joined up with the group. The captain's secretary was left with a commander called Soman, Tregaskis, my marine servant, and a number of others, about 10 or a dozen of us, and we worked our way through the ship on the starboard side, gradually working through compartments, rescuing people and putting out fires and doing what was necessary. I finished up on the quarter deck, on the forecastle, as the ship was arriving in harbour, and I took over as forecastle officer because the forecastle officer was the first lieutenant. He was deeply engaged in damage control. So I arrived up there, and of course I was trained as a seaman, and took over as forecastle officer for the berthing as the ship limped into harbour and went alongside at Palatoria Wharf in Grand Harbour. She was burning for several days inside. We air crew were evacuated out to Halfar, and I went in the next day to the ship to rescue what kit I could. It was all absolutely sodden, everything all closed, everything else was absolutely swimming in firefighting water and sodden through, well, a certain amount one could get, which was usable just. And then I went to Imtafa Hospital, the military hospital, to see the wounded. I was going through a ward, and one of the first things that happened was a man called me over, a rating called me over, and said, "You're the officer who bandaged my hands on the quarterdeck." I said, "Yes, I think I am." He said, "Well, I want to thank you. I'm told that you saved my hands, so the doctors tell me." And that, I might say, is one of the most gratifying things. One used to spend hours practicing first aid. Lessons with the doctors in the wardroom where officers were compulsorily forced to do first aid training. And then it does pay off. The other thing that struck me particularly, I remember, about visiting Imtafa Hospital was a very heavily bandaged figure called me over, and he said, "Alfie," you know my nickname in the Navy was Alfie, and I went over to him, and I looked at him, and I didn't know him, there was a pair of eyes, and that's all, and there was a terrible burnt body, face, hands, and he then said, "I'm Sam." Sam Morford was one of my squadron mates, but he was so badly burnt that I didn't recognize him at all. But, of course, it was the start of the new methods of controlling burning, and he did recover. He never flew again, but he was slight scars on his face. He was fairly all right, but he never flew anymore. The bombing of the Illustrious. The sequel was that we saw the start of the Blitz on Malta from Halfar. I watched what appeared to be the whole of Leta going up in that mass of smoke and dust as the German dive bombers tried to knock out Illustrious before she, while she was still in the harbour. I went away in charge of quite a large body of the air crews to Alexandria in Malta in a cruiser, I can't remember which one, and took passage. I was in charge of the draft. And we went to Dakela Airport outside Alexandria. I almost straight away was sent off to the Western Desert All the people I'd taken there stayed behind in Dakhla. But I was appointed as naval liaison officer with the Air Force in the Western Desert. This was during the period of the first big advance by General Wavell's forces against the Italians. And this was a thrilling thing. I was with on the staff, appointed on the staff of Air Commodore Collishaw, who was the famous World War I flying ace, fighter pilot. And he had his army liaison officer, naval liaison officer with him all the time. A table, you sat next to him. At every staff meeting, you sat just close to him. And he had us there the whole time. And he, in actual fact, started to educate me in air warfare, because here was a man who had had all the experience of the First World War and who at this stage had gained air superiority over the Italian Air Force and was enabling Wavell to do that terrific advance where he defeated the whole of the Italian armies in taking Benghazi. Quite an experience for a young officer. I went with him. One of the purposes of my being there was that we had naval aircraft, as they were gradually, the squadrons reformed, sent up to operate in the desert in support of the Air Force, and therefore one had me as a naval officer on the Air Force staff issuing the orders for the naval squadrons. I got as far as Benghazi when the Germans started attacking it. They were using mines to mine the harbour and also to blow the town apart while the British occupied it. I was a junior chap on the staff. The whole of the Air Force staff, and I think quite a lot of the army, had moved into the Hotel Berenice on the waterfront at Benghazi. And the air marshals and all these important people, they had front rooms overlooking the sea. Sutton, being a mere junior naval lieutenant, had a little slit of a side room, which I think belonged to one of the chambermaids. So, but when the Germans started bombing, I was the one who was laughing. All the high-ups came down looking very bruised and very disturbed. Next morning, the front of the hotel had been blown in, the back had been blown out, whereas my little side room had been quite safe. That was that. The advance then went on, and I began to get reports of Germans landing in North Africa. There were reports coming in to the Air Force, reports coming in to from Arabs, Bedouins, and so on. And I started sending these back to Alexandria, and I got very rough time. I got the staff officer to the flag officer air on the telephone to me, saying, "Sutton, pull yourself together. For God's sake, you're getting windy. There are no Germans in Africa." I said, "But," they said, "shut up, there are no Germans in Africa. Now do your job properly." Anyhow, there were Germans in Africa. And the squadron of albacores was sent up to operate under the air marshal, the air commodore. And I gave them all clear. Beyond a certain point, I said, "There are no British forces at all. Anything you see can be sunk." And they came back and they said, "Alfie, you're right. Submarine right on the surface. Saw it in the moonlight." I said, "Together?" "Didn't see a sink. Torpedo seemed to run all right, but didn't see a sink." Next thing I knew was a signal. Lieutenant Sutton report to Commander-in-Chief forthwith. This was Cunningham. So I I didn't know what why it was forthwith. Forthwith to me meant absolutely straight away. So I got into an aircraft and I flew from half the length of Africa to Alexandria, got into a car, still unshaven and a bit smelly from the desert, in khaki, and reported to the commander-in-chief. Now, Cunningham was a most punctilious man and a martinet, and I got the biggest blast of my life. How dare you come and see your commander-in-chief like that? I said, I've been ordered to see you forthwith. Said, forthwith? You mean to say, come to me in a uniform like that? I was a bit grubby, I must say, but after all, I hadn't had a laundry for 6 weeks or so. And that's how I smelt. Anyhow, he then said, what do you mean by sinking my, trying to sink my submarines? I said, submarines? He said, you've tried to sink the Torpe. And this was Myers' submarine, the VC, the submariner, who'd been sent up there, without my being informed, to intercept the enemy shipping which I had said was going in. I was obviously so astounded and so flummoxed that they did believe me. Then Cunningham then became more reasonable and started to chat. I had a reputation, and he knew I was the chap who'd found the Italian fleet before and so on. And he said, why, you used to be in destroyers under me. And he'd been the flag officer of destroyers, and I'd been in the Mediterranean destroyers. And I said, yes, sir. And we talked about that. And then he dismissed me. But I got back to the Air Force to find out what had happened. And yes, the signal had arrived. But the signal had been marked to senior staff officer for action. And the senior staff officer had seen it the next morning and had mentioned it to naval liaison officer. And by the time it got round to me, I was on the carpet in front of the commander-in-chief. Anyhow, it taught me that if you are in any job like that, you've got to make certain how your communications are working and that you know how the routine in another service works, which I hadn't known up to then. I then made quite sure that I was on a number of Air Force staffs, and then onwards, one of the first things I did was to make quite certain that the unit which dealt with the incoming communications knew precisely who I was, and what I wanted. I was recalled from the desert. Then what happened? Oh yes, that was the Greek campaign. Recalled to the desert and sent to Greece. Now, what had happened was that after the bombing of the Illustrious, the hangars had been decimated. Most of the action had been in the hangars. And we had had a strange routine of standing by one's aircraft. This is a drive from the Air Force, and a drive again from the First World War, and divided in turn from the Army. You stood by your aircraft in the way that the cavalrymen stood by their horses. So in action stations, one stood by one's aircraft. Wham! And so the air crews had poured into the hangar to stand by their aircraft for orders. And the next thing was that the bomb after bomb had got off in the hangar. And in the bombing of the Illustrious, they had metal interlinked fire curtains which came down like a roll-top desk and divided up the hangar. And when the bombs went off, these fire curtains disintegrated and went whirling through the hangar rather like the sides on Boadicea's chariots, cutting off bits. And the most terrible carnage took place. What's more, people in the hangar were then being helped by other people after the first bomb, were caught by the second bomb. For instance, I remember Dick Janvin, who's a retired Vice Admiral, Sir Richard Janvin now, had got up into an aircraft to get out the first aid kit. to treat somebody when he was caught by the second bomb, blew half his backside off. There was a chap in my squadron, Macaulay, who eventually was killed at DSC in 2 bars. He was talking to the senior pilot of 815 squadron in the hangar when the second bomb went off, and Macaulay said it was incredible, like a point going through cheese. One saw the bomb, there was a terrific clang, and one saw this bloody thing coming through the ceiling of the hangar. And he said, we started to run. He said, I tripped over a ring bolt and fell flat on my face. Macaulay went on running and lost his head. Blew off. Kemp went on running and lost his head. This is one of the disasters of the of 815 Squadron. Now, Kemp was the senior pilot of 815 Squadron. They'd lost their commanding officer, Williamson, at Taranto. A senior pilot, the acting commanding officer, now had his head blown off in the bombing of the Illustrious. And then, I told you I was recalled from the desert, and my purpose of being recalled was to operate 815 Squadron in Greece. I was sent up on the staff of the Air Officer Commanding Greece, Air Marshal Dorbiak, and 815 Squadron had been reformed from the remnants of 815 and 819. The two squadrons were put together. I was odd man out. I became the staff officer for operating the squadron, sent up to Athens, and the squadron then, under a chap called Jago, first of all was based at that little airstrip in Crete to the west of Ceuta Bay called Malame, which is being carved out of the hillsides by Greek workmen for the Navy, a dirt airfield. And then they came on up into Greece. They were based, first of all, at, I can't remember the airfield it's called, one near the Royal Palace, Toi, the Royal Palace, there's an airfield there, so Menidi airfield. There was a discussion with the Air Force staff as to how it would be used, and the purpose was, really, that they wanted to use them against the Italian attack on Greece in the west of Greece. After considerable discussion as to where they could be based, it was decided that the best way to use them was to put them up at a temporary airfield at a place called Paramathia, right up in the mountains, in the Epirus Mountains, a bit inland from Corfu, and that there they could attack the Italian base ports and Italian shipping and try and halt the absolute influx of Italians into that part of Greece. Menidi was too far away, it was the wrong side of Athens for that, so we shifted across to another airfield called Alephsis, and then we started a routine of each moon period during the March and April moons periods of that year, 1941, of operating against the Italians. Now, the first attack was against the Italian harbour of Bologna. The Greek general staff had briefed us on this. Jager, the senior observer called Caldecott Smith, and I had attended